Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Command Show.
Titan 5, Engine 101.
With Anthony Castros and Ed Hadfield. Let's start the show.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the Command Show. It's Ed Hadfield here coming to you from a dry and windy Southern California. We've got about our seasonal Santa Ana's blowing through here right now, anywhere between 40, 50, and up to 70 miles an hour. Wind speeds. As many of you know that follow the show and are from the West Coast, we've been handling some pretty major fires recently. These fires are not new. These are the same fires that I was on in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. Malibu burns about every 10 to 12 years, has the same burn scar, burns in the same direction, usually starting somewhere in the Simi Valley, Thousand Oaks area, burning across the 101 and hits the Malibu colonies, and that's what it did again. The only difference is celebrities build their houses in the way all the time and are typically surprised by the outcome. There should be no surprise. Fuel weather and topography doesn't change. The only thing that changes is the fuel model, and fuel models are typically homes. So, welcome to Southern California, Mr. Celebrity. Anyway, things are going good. Andoni and I are going to be on the show tonight. He's going to be calling in from a remote location, the world's happiest place. And I'm actually in the world's happiest place right now. I'm at home in my office / studio and having a great time. We are on standby alert for fires breaking down in our area. We've had a couple small starts, but some of the things that we've been doing, and for those of you that are from California, then I apologize because this will be redundant. For those of you that are outside of California, California Professional Firefighters, CPF, and California Fire Chiefs Association, Cal Chiefs, really worked aggressively from a political standpoint together to pass a funding mechanism through the Greenhouse Gas Initiative that would allow local municipalities or local fire service, fire districts, city fire departments to be funded, reimbursed for pre-positioning of resources. So where I'm at in San Diego County, we've been doing that on our own dime for some period of time. We realized that when we assemble or pre-position task force or strike teams, and strike team is five like engines with a leader, common form of communication. A task force is a combination of variables such as two type 1 engines or triple combination pumpers, three type 3 engines, which would be your brush rigs, or maybe it's two type 1s, two type 3s, and a type 6, which is usually a patrol unit, and a strike team leader, or a task force leader, excuse me. So, following the 2003-2007 fires, we realized that the more immediate resources we can get onto an incident, the quicker we can jump on it, the smaller it stays. That's kind of a no-brainer there, right? And of course, that goes along with air assets and a strong incident command system. But you know, the municipalities that were upstaffing and holding people over and going into a tactical standby, you know, we were paying for it out of our own general funds. And so now we get reimbursement from the state up to $25 million per year for this pre-positioning of resources. So that's where we're at in San Diego, because the Southern California's got the winds right now, the sustained Santa Ana's. San Diego, being the cul-de-sac of the state, is really at risk. You know, the last, quote, major fire that we had was in 2007, so we're due 11 years. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't had a series of significant events, because we have. We had the Lilac Fire where, you know, that was a few months ago. We burned up 150 homes. We had the West Fire where we burned up 56 homes. You know, we get a lot of fires down here in San Diego. And it's not uncommon for us to lose 100 homes in one day. You know, most communities lose 100 homes in a day, and you know, they never recover. Unfortunately, because of our topography, because of our resource availability at times, like right now, and I'll expand upon that, we tend to get these fires that move quickly with the winds and the fuel and the weather and topography, and they move through and they take out the homes and businesses, and they, you know, they're 6, 8, 10, 12-hour fires, and then they're out. So what we're doing is utilizing the funding mechanism from DRISC, which was approved by the state of California, by Governor Brown, is that we have assembled throughout the county strike teams. And these strike teams float through the county. So they have a geographic region that they work in, and they're just floating around, and they're waiting for a response. And boom, when we get a response, we get a reinforced response. You get your normal first alarm assignment, plus you're getting the additional resources that are pre-positioned, plus you're getting additional overhead for incident management. And it works very well for us. And it's working well for us in the last couple of days. You know, I think that's going to be a little bit of a game changer for how we do things in California. Now, obviously, the campfire, which is up in Oroville, Butte, in that area, you know, moved through, and it just disseminated the entire town of Paradise, which is sad and tragic. You know, sometimes we just can't get out of the way. You know, sometimes these wind-driven fires are gonna drive the incident for us. All we can do is try and protect. And as an example, the Malibu fire, or the Woolsey fire, as it's being called. You know, the strike team that my organization was a party to on the first night of the deployment. They moved into Bell Canyon, and I've been into Bell Canyon many times throughout my career, and I will tell you, Bell Canyon's scary. Bell Canyon is a fireman eater. It's going to move through there. It's going to do what it wants to do, and it's going to eat everything that's in its path. But under the leadership and command of a strong strike team leader, some really good tactical decision making from company officers, and some aggressive work from firefighters moving into Bell Canyon, our strike team was directly responsible for saving 25 homes and an additional 5 in another area of the canyon from a direct hit from the fire moving through, heading towards the Great Pacific Firebreak. So, you know, you can make a difference in a lot of these incidents, but they're going to be small victories. And in these particular small victories, you just have to say, hey, we saved that house, you know, and, you know, it's sad and it's tragic that maybe we lost 10 or 15 others, but at the end of the day, we saved this one, and this was the one that we wanted to save and tried to save, because it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult in what we're doing because, again, you know, these are, you know, homes that, you know, where you're putting an engine company or maybe two engine companies or maybe even a strike team on a series of homes. And, you know, some of these homes, particularly in Malibu, are extremely large. I mean, they're not homes, they're mansions. They're, you know, 10, 15, 20,000 square feet. They're, you know, built right on the edge of a canyon or built, you know, right at the top of a saddle or, you know, they try and maximize, obviously, the footprint, but they're trying to maximize their views. Now, nobody, you know, nobody wants to build a multi-million dollar home and not have a view. Well, with views comes slope. And with slope comes, you know, that topography that we talked about and the preheating of the incident where the bottom of these canyons, at the bottom of these drainages, at the bottom of these gullies, it's going to heat up. It's going to start heating up the fuel ahead of it. It's going to start off-gassing. It's going to have explosive fire behavior. And that's somebody with a weed blower. Sorry about that. And it's going to hit these homes, and it's going to just, it's same thing. These homes are going to be preheated, and they're just going to explode. So sometimes you can only do what, you know, what the good Lord's going to let you do. Sorry about that. I had to take a little drink of water. So what we're talking about right now is how do these incidents, you know, how do we manage them? And I think, you know, I think when we look at, I'll say the fire scope, the ICS model, you know, we do it really well. And what we're seeing, and what we're seeing on the Woolsey fire, I think is just, it's great. You know, not only are we seeing, you know, local fire, you know, initiate, which, you know, was Ventura to LA County, you know, Joint Unified Command with LA City involved, but really our law enforcement partners really came together. And this is the one fire where I saw myself where law enforcement maximized the use of mutual and automatic aid agreements amongst themselves, and started divisioning and grouping off some of their functions, much like we are. And that only creates not only for a better, safer environment, but a more seamless incident command system, because that law branch really begins to take fold in these bigger incidents. And not only, you know, are we talking about handling traffic flow and road closures and stuff like that, but actual security. Because, you know, one of the things that we saw in 2007 in certain areas of San Diego, was there was, when people were evacuated, the local criminal element was like, wow, nobody's there. Guess what that means? It means I can go burglarize this house because the cops are busy, the firemen aren't going to do anything about it, and nobody's there to stop me. That's, I think, being addressed at a greater level at the Woolsey fire, is because you're seeing, you know, Woolsey fires in the Malibu area, which is northwestern LA County. And what you're seeing is you know, law enforcement agencies from Irwindale, which is the, you know, the eastern portion of the county. You're seeing Gardena, which is the southern portion of the county. You're seeing Orange County units. You know, you're seeing law enforcement units from throughout the Southern California area being folded into the incident command system, and being folded into a branch that has obviously taken that branch, and now they've got their geographic and functional elements, you know, their geographic divisions and their functional elements, which is their different groups and that. It's amazing to see, and it's a great partnering, and I think we're so much further ahead than we were in 2007. And I, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of it has come effect as a reason, as a result of, you know, all of our active shooter and mass shooter, you know, events. You know, when you think about the most recent one, which occurred in the, you know, the Thousand Oaks area, that was just literally the day before the Woolsey fire, you know. So here, that particular region, you know, Ventura County, which is just an amazing, beautiful county. It's an a great group of people. They have some of the best fire service firefighters that you could ever imagine. Some of the greatest law enforcement personnel as well. It's truly a gem of an area. They have a college night event at a local bar. It's a country western bar. Individual decides to go in there and cause a mass shooting, killing 12 people and himself. The community's starting to grieve, and then boom, the Woolsey fire kicks off and just overshadows it, and it's tragic. And you know, there's going to be a need, particularly for our fire and law personnel, to decompress when this is all over. The firefighters that were working the evening or the day of the mass shooting, no doubt in my mind, and I don't know this for fact, so I'm going to make a guess, is that many of those firefighters that responded to that incident or were on duty the evening of that incident or somehow or another affected by it are also on duty and have remained on duty for the Woolsey fire. And they haven't had an opportunity to decompress. They haven't, maybe they haven't had an opportunity to go home to their families. And if they have, they're probably been called back and were immediately deployed and put right out on this. And this is part of that behavioral health aspect that, you know, a lot of people need to understand the effects and the importance of, you know, why we need stronger, better programs, more behavioral health programs, why we need standard operating guidelines for how things occur, because I don't know if it is true, but, you know, if we did have firefighters that responded to that event, the mass shooting, dealt with that incident, you know, we're back at the station the following day, and maybe they're working, you know, an additional shift, a time trade, an overtime, a force hire, whatever, and then they get kicked off and they go to the Woolsey fire, and they're out there for 3, 4, 5, 6 days. That's going to be very difficult on them because of the inability and of decompression and the inability to actually grieve and the inability to be able to manage your emotions because you're just basically running on adrenaline. And when they come down off of that and that crash, if there's not the support there for them, it's going to be really tough. So, you know, we need to make sure as chief officers and as command officers that we're doing our best to make sure that our personnel that are party to some of these more significant threshold, as Gordon Graham calls them, threshold events, that we're aware of their schedule. We're aware of whether we're putting them back out on the line. We're aware of the criticality of the continued work mode that we put them in. And it's not uncommon. I mean, it's, you know, this time of year, you know, it's getting closer to the holidays. We're dealing with a lot of the fires in Southern California, which we fully anticipated because of the wind shift. Personnel are going to be stretched thin. It becomes particularly hard on those individuals that are, you know, younger to the fire service. They have young families, they're, you know, significant others, wives, husbands, significant others are at home with the children, and all they would do is they just want their loved one to come home, and, you know, they can't come home. So it becomes part of that bigger complex problem that we have to manage more readily as chief officers. So I just got a text from Andoni. He said he's not going to be able to call in. We're going to cut this one a little bit short tonight. We'll talk about a couple more items, and we'll kick it off. This particular one of the things that I want to talk about was this particular day, actually a year ago. A year ago, we were in. I was in Fresno. I was teaching. I was doing the show. I was doing the show myself, and it happened to be about 4 or 5 days following the death of a very close friend and mentor, Chief Alan Brunicini. Kind of hard to believe that Chief Brunicini's been gone now for a year, a little over a year. You know, it's one of those surreal things that occurs in your fire service career where you just think that the individual is going to be there forever. He's going to be, he or she are going to be a phone call away. He or she are going to be, you know, just an email or a text away. And unfortunately, you know, that's not the case. That's not life. We never know. And so, you know, one of the things that I try to impress upon people is to recognize that, you know, the time that we do have here on Earth is very short, and the impact that you can make on people is very great. Obviously, we're all human. We're all fallible. We all make our mistakes. I wish particularly myself I could go back and erase probably about 5/8 of my life where I just did really dumb things. I said dumb things. And unfortunately, I can't. And I have to atone for those, and I have to recognize that those were things that I did that hopefully I can learn from. But one of the things that I think is important for all of us is to take time to mentor somebody that is looking for that mentorship, to help guide somebody who is looking for that guidance, to be a friend of somebody who needs a friend, to be a listening ear to somebody who needs just a listening ear. You know, it's not that hard to be a good human. Sometimes I struggle with it. Actually, a lot of times I struggle with it. Sometimes I, you know, you try to do the right thing and you just get, you know, squashed on, and your automatic reaction is, well, screw that, you know, I'm not going to do that again. But that's not the right thing to do. And I catch myself saying things to my kids, and then I have to stop and say, okay, well, you know, as I say that to my kids, I got to make sure I do that myself. And, you know, we're all, again, fallible. We're all going to make mistakes. But the key is that each and every day, we just try and be nice. And, you know, some of the things that Chief Brunicini used to say to me, you know, are so true. One of the things that he said, and I've probably said it on the show before, was he said, stop looking over your shoulder and looking behind you. He said, there's nothing good back there, and nobody's having any fun anyway. That's why they're behind you. And I thought about that, and I kind of snickered, and he goes, if they really wanted to have fun, they'd be next to you, and you'd both be looking forward. I think that's a very clear statement to make, is that while we can learn from the past and we can recognize that those mistakes that we made, you know, we don't want to make again, don't live in the past. You can't correct it. It's already been done. And that was another one of his famous sayings to me, was he said, as an incident commander, you can't get back what's already been burned. So don't worry about it. Worry about the exposures. Worry about the extension. Worry about what's not burned. And I think that's true in life. You know, what we've done in the past, we can't fix. It's already broken. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't go back and apologize for it. Absolutely not. We can atone for it. We can apologize for it. We can own it. We should do those things. But when that's done and over, that's done and over. Move on. Don't continue to go back, because then you're just trying to become a martyr. You know, Chief Brunicini, when we were bringing Blue Card into San Diego County, the bastion of ICS, we were walking across the street on actually Coast Highway right across from the thing. And he said, Eddie, he says, they're going to tar and feather you. He said, but like a good friend, you'll always have a bed at my house. And he was right. I was one of the first individuals to bring Blue Card into this county. I literally received hate email, hate phone calls. I mean, literally, people called me up, called me everything but a 6'3" guy. I kept some of those emails because they're pretty funny. I always love when people send you hate email and they misspell things. It's awesome. But the bottom line is that when he said that, while I knew I didn't need a bed to sleep in, basically what he was saying is my house is your home. And, you know, one of the things that we need to recognize is that there are times in people's lives where you need to open not only your arms but your doors. And I've seen this so true in New York, back in the 80s and 90s, when as a firefighter, you would go to New York for whatever reason, you knock on a fire station door looking for directions or a good recommendation on a restaurant, and they would invite you in, and you felt like you were truly one of them. They made you feel warm and welcomed. When you're at the fire station, when you're at the firehouse and somebody comes to visit, invite them in. Allow them to come into your home and make it their home. There's no other feeling than making your home, making somebody else feel as though your home is their home and that they're welcomed there, no matter what the circumstance. I think that's, you know, very important as well. And then lastly, one of the things that, you know, Chief Brunicini used to say, and I found it to be so true, is he said, Mrs. Smith doesn't care what color your fire engine is, what the seal on the door says, what the patch on your sleeve says, or whether or not you have a mullet, you're bald, you're fat, you're skinny, or you got 20-inch arms. He said, all Mrs. Smith cares about is that you're nice and that you show up and you take care of her emergency, and you make sure that Fluffy is doing okay. You straighten the pictures on the wall, you lock up the door before you leave, and you leave her world better than the way you found it and better than the way it was when she called you. At the end of the day, our job is about service. And, you know, I still hear people complaining about this job, and while by no means is it perfect, by no means is there things that can't be corrected, but usually when something's wrong with the job, it's not the job, it's a person issue. I hate going to work because of so-and-so or because of this. Well, is it because of it's the fire service, or is it because somebody's doing something to cause it to be bad? We don't hire bad people. We tend to breed them. Dinosaurs lay eggs. If you put a rookie with a crew that is negative and dysfunctional, then you'll have a negative and dysfunctional firefighter for the rest of his life. If you put people with people that understand the role and the function of the fire service, understand the importance of the strong work ethic and discipline and having fun at the same time, then that's the type of person that you'll be developing. So last year I got a little teary-eyed and pretty choked up when at the end of the show, because I was thinking about Chief Brunicini, and he was definitely a mentor and a friend and somebody that I adored and I missed. You know, I still miss him, and I'm not going to get teary-eyed and choked up today because I thought it was pretty silly. But I am going to say that there's a lot of people out there that deserve my thanks, and really the list is too long for even this show. But there are some people that I want to thank, and those are definitely my close friends from the Firetown community, Todd Wernette, Steve Reno, Joe Farica, Wes Kitchell, Brian Madsen. You guys have been by my side for many, many years, and there's many more associated to that. But that core group of guys have always been there, and I truly appreciate it. I truly do. I want to thank my good friend Andoni Castros for everything he's done for me and for the friendship that he's brought to my life. He's like a brother to me. I can't thank him enough for all that he's done. Obviously, there's a little-known individual that's I like to refer to as my life coach, and that's Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna, who seems to have an incredible knack of knowing when I need a pat on the back, when I need a swift kick in the butt, or when I need a listening ear. And if you don't have a person in your life that could fill that role that Sam fills for me, you need to find one. And then, of course, I think the granddaddy of them all and the individual that just taught us how to be nice is Chief Alan Brunicini. He was a great man. He still is a great man. We miss him dearly. And we just try and do our best to carry on the legacy that he has. This show could not be what it is without Chief Bobby Halton's friendship, mentorship, guidance, and support. And we thank Chief Bobby Halton as well. So with that, we're going to cut it short because, it's Veterans Day weekend. And there's a lot of amazing people that have given us this freedom to be able to do this show. And that's each and every veteran out there. And we thank you dearly from the bottom of our heart. God bless America. God bless every veteran that has ever served this country. We thank you. And with that, as usual, I'll sign off by saying that my good friend Timmy Alameda says, we'll see you on the radio.